Part 6. A Taste of Tough.
My career is littered with the corpses of dead series. I launched my Starring series with The Second Kind of Loneliness and Nor the Many Colored Fires of a Starring, then lost interest and never did a third story. A Peripheral Affair was meant to be followed by the further adventures of the starship Good Ship Lollipop. None ever appeared, for the simple reason that none was ever written. My Corpse Handle series went all the way to 3. Nobody Leaves New Pittsburgh began it, Override followed, and Meat House Man brought it to, well, a finish, if not an end. A fourth story exists as a 4-page fragment, and there are ideas in my files for a dozen more. I once intended to write them all, publish them in the magazines, then collect them all together in a book I'd call Songs the Dead Men Sing. But that fourth story never got finished, and the others never got started. When I finally did use the title Songs the Dead Men Sing for a collection, from Dark Harvest in 1983, Meat House Man was the only corpse story to make the cut. I fared somewhat better with the Windhaven series, perhaps because Lisa Tuttle and I were collaborating on that one, so I had someone to give me a swift kick whenever my creative juices dried up. Lisa also added some swell creative juices of her own. We started out trying to write a short story, which turned into the novella The Storms of Windhaven, a Hugo and Nebula loser, at the prompting of analog editor Ben Bova. One Wing and The Fall followed two more novellas. Then Lisa and I put the three of them together, added a prologue and an epilogue, and published Windhaven, a classic example of the fix-up novel, a novel made by cobbling together a series of previously published short stories or novellas. Windhaven wasn't supposed to be the end of Windhaven, however. Lisa and I meant to continue the tale through two more books and two more generations, showing how the changes Maris started in the storms of Windhaven continued to transform her world. The second book was to be entitled Painted Wings. The protagonist would be the little girl we'd introduced in The Fall, all grown up. We never wrote it. We talked about writing it for years, but the timing never worked out. When I was free, Lisa was in the throes of a novel. When she was free, I was out in Hollywood or doing Wild Cards or a novel of my own. We were 1,000 miles apart even when we were closest. Then I went west, to Santa Fe and Los Angeles, and she went east, to England and Scotland, and we saw each other less and less often. Also, as we grew older, our voices and styles and ways of looking at the world grew more and more distinct, which would have made collaborating far more challenging. Literary collaboration is a game for young writers, I think, or for old, cynical ones trying to cash in on their names. So our Painted Wings never took flight. My other series all proved to be even shorter, as I've mentioned here and there throughout these commentaries. There was the Steel Angel series, one story. The Shara series, one story. The Grey Alice series, one story. The Woe and Shade series, one story. The Skin Trade series, one story. It's enough to make one suspect a terminal case of creatus interruptus. Ah, but then comes Tough. Haviland Tough, ecological engineer, master of the Ark, and protagonist of Tough Voyaging, which is either a collection of short stories or a fix-up novel, depending on whether you're a critic or a publisher. 'Twas Tough who broke my series bugaboo for good and all, and opened up the gates for Wild Cards and A Song of Ice and Fire. As a reader, I had my own favorite series characters. In fantasy, I was drawn to Moorcock's Elric and Howard's Solomon Kane, and I loved Fritz Leiber's dashing rogues, Fofford and the Grey Mouser. In SF, I was fond of Retief, of Dominic Flandry, of Lijah Bailey and R. Daniel Olivaw. But my favorites had to be Jack Vance's galactic effectuator, Magnus Ridolf, and Paul Anderson's fat, scheming merchant prince of the spaceways, Nicholas Van Ryn. As a writer, I still had dreams of establishing a popular, long-running series of my own, and I had an idea that I was certain would sustain one as well. It was 1975, and ecology was a word on everyone's lips. It seemed to me the series about some sort of biogenetic engineer who moves from world to world solving, or in some cases creating, ecological problems would offer no end of story possibilities. The subject matter would allow me to explore all sorts of juicy issues, and best of all, No one else had done anything remotely like it, so far as I knew. But who was this fellow? It seemed to me that I had a terrific concept, but to sustain a series I needed a terrific character as well, someone the readers would enjoy following story after story. With that in mind, I went back and looked at some of the characters that I had loved as a reader. Nicholas Van Ryn, Conan, Sherlock Holmes, Mowgli, Travis McGee, Horatio Hornblower, Elric of Melniboné, Batman, Northwest Smith, Flashman, Fofford and the Mouser, Retief, Susan Calvin, Magnus Ridolph. A diverse bunch, certainly. I wanted to see if they shared any traits in common. They did. Two things leapt out at me. One, they all had great names, names that fit them perfectly. Memorable names, singular names. You would not like to meet two Horatio Hornblowers. Melniboné's phone book would not list four Elrics. Northwest Smith was not required to use his middle initials to distinguish himself from all the other Northwest Smiths. Secondly, every one of them was larger than life. No average Joes in this bunch. No danger of any of them vanishing into the wallpaper. Many of them are supreme in their own spheres, be that naval warfare, Hornblower, deduction, Holmes, hand-to-hand combat, Conan, or cowardice and lechery, Flashman. Most of them are severely idiosyncratic, to say the least. There's surely a place in fiction for small, commonplace, realistic characters, subtly rendered, but not as the star of an ongoing series. Okay, I thought to myself, I can do that. Thus was born Haviland Tuff, merchant, cat lover, vegetarian, big and bald, drinking mushroom wine and playing God, a fussy man and formal, who has long since veered past idiosyncrasy into out-and-out eccentricity. There's some of Holmes and Ridolph in him, a pinch of Nicholas Van Ryn, a little Hercule Poirot, and a lot of Alfred Hitchcock, but not much of me at all. Of all my protagonists, Tuff is the least like myself, although I did own a cat named Dox, though he was not telepathic. The name? Well, Haviland was a surname I noticed on the wall charts at a chess tournament I was directing. I'm not at all certain where the Tuff came from. When I put the two of them together, though, that was him, and never a doubt. Back in the 70s, I was still trying to place my stories in as wide a variety of markets as possible. I wanted to prove that I could sell to anybody, not just the same few editors. Also, I figured that every time I had a story in a new market, I would reach new readers who might then go on to look for my stuff elsewhere. Working on that theory, I sold the first Haviland Tuff story to a British hardcover anthology called Andromeda, edited by Peter Weston. Perhaps A Beast for Norn did indeed win me legions of new British readers, I couldn't say. Unfortunately, very few of my old American readers ever found the story, until St. Martin's printed an American edition of Andromeda 3 years later. By that time, I had already published a second Tuff story, Call Him Moses. I'd sold that one to Ben Bova. Thereafter, Tuff became a familiar figure in the pages of Analog. Ben and his successor, Stanley Schmidt, got first look at each new Tuff story and bought them all. Not that there were a great many. Tuff was fun, but he was by no means the only fish in my fry pan. In the late 70s, I was still teaching at Clark College, so my writing time was limited, and I had other stories I wanted to tell. And when I moved to Santa Fe at the end of 1979 to try and make a go of it as a full-time writer, my attention shifted to novels. Fever Dream occupied most of my writing time in 1981, The Armageddon Rag in 1982, Black and White and Red All Over in 1984. We won't talk about 1983, my lost year. The Tuff series might well have petered out at three or four stories, but for Betsy Mitchell. Betsy had been the assistant editor at Analog under Stan Schmidt, but in 1984 she left the magazine to become an editor at Bain Books. Not long after joining Bain, she phoned to ask if I had ever considered doing a collection of Haviland Tuff's adventures. I had, of course, but that was for eventually, some future time when I had accumulated enough Tuff stories to make a book. In 1984, I had maybe half a book at best. Still, Betsy's offer was not one I could refuse. My career was in serious trouble just then. The readers had ignored the Armageddon rag in droves, and as a result, no editor would touch Black and White and Red All Over. This was a chance to get back into the game. I could write some more tough tales, sell first serial rights to Stan Schmidt at Analog, put them all together for Betsy, make enough money to pay my mortgage for a little while longer. So I wrote The Plague Star, the tale of how Tuff came to be the master of the Ark, followed by the Suthlam triptych, which gave the book a spine. Bain published Tuff Voyaging in February 1986 as a novel. My fifth novel, some say, though I've always counted Tuff Voyaging as a short story collection. In my own mind, Black and White and Red All Over will forever be my fifth novel, broken and unfinished though it is. No sampling of my checkered career could possibly be complete without A Taste of Tuff, so I've included two stories here. The rest can be found in Tuff Voyaging, for those who want more. A Beast for Norn was the earliest Tuff story, written in 1975 and published in 1976. When it came time for me to assemble Tuff Voyaging for Betsy in 1985, a decade had passed, and Haviland Tuff had changed somewhat, coming more into focus, as it were. The Tuff of A Beast for Norn no longer quite fit, so I decided to revise and expand the story to bring the proto-Tuff more in line with the character as he'd evolved in the later stories. It is the revised version of A Beast for Norn that appears in Tuff Voyaging. For this retrospective, however, I thought it might be interesting to go back to my first take on Tuff. So what follows is the original version of A Beast for Norn, as it appeared in Andromeda in 1976. Guardians is of somewhat later vintage, having first been published in Analog in October 1981. It was the most popular entry in the series with the readers, winning the Locus Poll as Best Novelette of the Year and garnering a Hugo nomination. It finished second in the final balloting, losing the award to Roger Zelazny's superb Unicorn Variations. Roger was a dear friend of mine, and I had suggested the idea for Unicorn Variations to him jokingly one day as we drove to Albuquerque for a writer's lunch. Roger acknowledged that with a tip of the hat by naming his protagonist Martin, and then went right out and took my Hugo. At one time, there was supposed to be a second Tuff book. Tuff Voyaging did well enough so that Betsy Mitchell suggested a sequel, either another book of collected stories or perhaps a genuine full-length novel. I was willing. I had ideas for another dozen Tuff stories in my files. So contracts were duly drawn up and signed, and the book was even announced in Locus. Our working title was Twice as Tuff, although if I had gone the novel route, I probably would have changed that to Tuff Landing. It never happened. Hollywood intervened, and I found myself out in L.A., making as much money in 2 weeks as the Twice as Tuff contract would have paid me for a year's work. I needed money badly at that time in the wake of Armageddon Rag's disastrous sales and a failure of Black and White and Red All Over to sell. When the deadline came and went without a book, I suggested to Betsy that I might bring in a collaborator who could write the stories from my outlines. I take contracts seriously and wanted to fulfill mine with Bain if at all possible. But taking on a partner really wasn't a very good idea. Betsy Mitchell did not think so either, and she talked me out of it. For that, I remain grateful. She was right. Tuff stories written by someone else would not have been the same. I would have been cheating Bain Books, my readers, and myself. I ended up settling the Twice as Tuff contract by granting Bain Books to write to reprint some of my older books, so everyone ended up reasonably happy, except the Tuff fans. There are still a number of those about, actually. Every year, for a decade or more, a few letters have come trickling in, urging me to stop writing wild cards, or those TV shows, or that series of big fat fantasy novels, so I can write some more Haviland Tuff stories instead. To which I can only say, maybe one of these days, when you least expect it.